from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. That was the sound of victory today. Just before 7 a.m. this morning, the snub-nosed, star-spangled Spaceship One rose from the Mojave Desert in California, climbed piggyback to 50,000 feet on another plane, then streaked at Mach 3 into space and into the record books. The half-hour flight took the rocket ship more than 69.7 miles high. And when it landed, Spaceship One came home the winner of the $10 million Ansari X Prize. To win, a spaceship capable of carrying three people had to make two flights to an altitude above 62 miles in less than 2 weeks. Back on Earth, Spaceship's one test pilot today, Brian Binney, said the flight was unlike anything he'd ever experienced and immediately began the victory-flushed marketing of private space travel.
It's a fantastic feeling. There's a freedom there and a sense of wonder that, I tell you what, you all need to experience.
Getting you to experience personal spaceflight is exactly what the people who built Spaceship One, Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen and designer Burt Rutan, have in mind. The big push behind the X Prize is about putting the private sector into space, space tourism, space industry. Here's how Paul Allen put it today before takeoff.
The real prize is being first and eventually being first to market with a ship that can capture a business that looks to be a multi-billion dollar per year business from the get-go.
47 years ago today, the Soviet Union made history with the launch of Sputnik. Today, above the Mojave Desert, Spaceship One made history by winning the X Prize. Tonight on Point, private enterprise takes to the final frontier. We'll look at the excitement and the implications. Are you ready for a ride in space? Are you ready to see private rocket ships zipping into orbit and beyond? Would you go? Are you happy to see commerce joining NASA on the high frontier? And where will it take us? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. In a moment, we'll be joined by Richard Branson, chairman of the Virgin Group, who, along with Paul Allen, announced last week that beginning in 2007, a new company, Virgin Galactic, will be offering suborbital flights for tourists. We'll also hear from Jeff Johnson, Paul Allen's director of aviation at Vulcan Incorporated, X-Prize chairman Peter Diamandis, Planetary Society executive director Louis Friedman, and more. But first, we go to Southern California. Peter Pei is aerospace writer for the Los Angeles Times and was at today's Spaceship One flight in the Mojave Desert. Peter Pei, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
So tell us about what you saw today, actually, from ground level, Peter.
Well, a flawless flight, quite unlike Wednesday's flight where the spaceship rolled 29 times and caused a lot of anxiety from those watching on ground.
That could give a tourist second thoughts.
Yes, actually, yes. And it did until today. Today was really a remarkable flight. It just went straight up, very little movement at all, very smooth, almost routine-like, which is exactly what these guys want to project.
And tell us exactly what Spaceship One did today to fulfill the winning requirements of the X Prize, the Ansari X Prize, Peter.
It completed second of two flights it was required to do within 2 weeks with a pilot and two passengers, or equivalent weight of those two passengers.
You were saying?
Go ahead.
It had to go above 62 miles, and what's the significance of that 62-mile mark?
62 miles or 100 kilometers has been pretty much set as the boundary of space. That's sort of the widely accepted norm that you are basically going out of the atmosphere. And when you get to that rate or that height, you can feel weightlessness, the sky goes pitch dark, and you can see pretty much about 1,000 miles in each direction.
So what does the Earth look like from 62 miles, or the flight today went 69.7 miles?
Well, I haven't been up there, but the commercial astronauts, Mike Melville and now Brian Binney, say that you can see the curvature. It's spectacular. As you heard Brian speak about, you need to go up there and see this. It is, to a lot of astronauts, a life-altering experience.
And these are, I guess, today at 69.7 miles, is that the highest that a private manned craft has ever flown?
It's not only the highest for a private manned craft, but it is also the highest for a winged craft. It beat the record set by X-15 back in 1963. That X-15 flew to 354,000 feet. This one went up to 13,000 feet more.
Remind us who sponsored this $10 million prize and what was their point in sponsoring it?
It's called the X Prize, and it was created by a man named Peter Diamandis. He's a Santa Monica entrepreneur, actually a frustrated astronaut. He wanted to be an astronaut. He could not be one. So he decided, hey, you know, if I wanted to go in space, I'm going to have to sort of create a private industry. And so he set up this prize. He was able to get a sponsor, a family by the name of Ansari, to put up what we call a premium. They had actually a very unique insurance policy set up in which insurance would pay the price if somebody was able to accomplish this within a certain period of time. If they didn't, then the insurance company would take the premium.
And off they went. They won the prize. The $10 million is in their pocket. Where does this go next, Peter Pei? They clearly have the capacity now. Are there laws, regulations? Do you need anyone's permission to make regular flights with tourists into space?
Lots of big questions. Regulatory, legal, business. Is there a viable business in this? Obviously, the folks here believe there are. There's regulatory. I mean, this is a new frontier. FAA does not have any regulations on how to certify, for instance, the aircraft for if it's airworthy or if it's safe. The only thing they can do right now is license the airport to launch the rocket to make sure that the rocket doesn't veer away and cause any injuries or death to uninvolved public, they call it.
That is people on the ground. But as we've all seen, Richard Branson at Virgin and Paul Allen have high hopes here. They're talking about $200,000 rides into space in 2007. That's not long from now.
No, it's not. And it's possible technologically that they can do it, because what they want to do is take Spaceship One, which went up today, and it's the third time it's been into space, make a larger version of that with seating for five people.
Pretty giddy out on the Mojave today, Peter?
Very. excitement everywhere.
Peter Pei, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
All right. Appreciate it.
Peter Pei, aerospace writer for the Los Angeles Times. We are looking at today's prize-winning flight into space and the future of what they're calling personal space flight. I'm joined now from Pasadena, California, by Peter Diamandis. He is chairman of the X Prize Foundation, which today awarded the $10 million prize. He's chairman of the Zero Gravity Corporation, a commercial space company. He's co-founder of the International Space University. Peter Diamandis, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. I'm actually sitting in the Office of Scaled Composites in Mojave, California.
Terrific.
About 20 meters away from Spaceship One, which looks beautiful.
It must look especially good tonight. This is where it all happened today. Also joining us just right now from London is Gregory Clerks. He's a space writer, author of Lost in Space, The Fall of NASA, and The Dream of a New Space Age. His article, Beyond the X Prize, What's Next for Private Space Travel, appeared in the September 18th edition of The New Scientist. Gregory Clerks, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Peter Diamandis, I didn't mean to cut you off. It's a big day for you. You're actually bestowing this prize. How's it feel?
It feels fantastic. We had, people from around the world, literally flying from Europe and Asia to be here to watch history made. We had a beautiful flight despite the rolls. The vehicle was under full control on September 29th. We called that flight X-1. Mm-hmm. And today, X-2, on the October 4th anniversary of Sputnik. How appropriate that is. The event in 1957 that kicked off the U.S.-Soviet race. Today is commemorated by the beginning of birth, once again, of what I call the personal spaceflight revolution. And to see this ship that literally can fit in your two-car garage go and make such a gorgeous flight, so simplistic. My mom, my folks were out here, and they looked at that, and my mom said, I can't believe such a simple ship can go into space. And that's exactly what we want to do. We want to change people's perspective about this. It isn't just for governments.
And what exactly is driving you? What's the vision that's got you fired up, Peter Diamandis?
The vision is one that, I heard Peter Pei a few minutes ago say I was a frustrated astronaut. That's true. I actually chose not to apply to the astronaut corps because of what it meant. If I was lucky enough to be selected, 1 in 1,000, then my chances of flying were maybe once or twice in a decade. Hmm. That's not my vision of spaceflight. What I'm hoping to do is be able to fly whenever I want, and that's what the team here at Mojave Aerospace has created a ship that people can buy tickets for, that people can own. It's really equivalent to the early Apple computer. Now, people said, well, you know, what's this, what's so substantial about Spaceship One? You know, governments have been doing this for 30 years. Well, it's like saying, why was the Apple computer important? Well, you can own it, and you can operate it.
Right. And this time you can fly it into space. Gregory Clerks, join us from London. You've been watching all this unfold. Peter Diamandis is really invested in all this. You're sitting as an observer. How do you assess the significance of what's happened today?
Well, I think it's tremendous. There has been an alternative space sector around for two decades and counting now, and that is a group of people who have believed that there is a different way to do human spaceflight other than the big government way. And I think what's been lacking until now, of course, is demonstrable proof that this can happen. And that's what Spaceship One is. It is the rubber meeting the road, so to speak. There is now an operational craft that can go into space and come back again. And what's more, it was done simply, it was done inexpensively, tremendously inexpensively by typical standards, and it's done it again and again and again. And it's a really exciting time for anybody who's interested in the future of human spaceflight.
So, Peter Diamandis, I have to ask you, when you got this organized to put up the $10 million prize, how long did you think it would take? Where are you in the timetable? Behind, ahead, right on schedule?
Well, it was in May of 96, under the arch in St. Louis. We had the administrator of NASA, associate administrator of the FAA, 20 astronauts there, and Lindbergh family announcing this prize. And at that time, I predicted the earliest I thought it would be won is 2001, and the latest would be 2004. So we were on the outside of the envelope. But I'll tell you, to see this ship and the beauty and grace with which it went to space, it was well worth the wait. We now have 25 other teams from seven countries around the world who are, shall we say, runners-up, waiting to make their flights and help move this industry forward.
And what's your vision for how all this will unfold? You don't want people to take, even astronauts, only one flight in a decade or two. But what is it that you see coming out of all this?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, the Ansari X Prize is not the end. It's actually, we announced today, it's the beginning of an annual event. We're going to be holding what's called the X Prize Cup in New Mexico. Governor Bill Richardson bid and won for the rights to have this. It's the Grand Prix of space. We're going to be inviting all the teams to one venue for 10 days every year, and we're going to invite them to fly as many times as they can, altitude records, time to climb, cross-distance records. It's, if you would, America's Cup meets Grand Prix auto racing. And we'll have live network coverage. We're doing some bidding right now to find our partner, reality television, and it's a place where you can bring your friends and family, touch the ships, meet the heroes, live and be part of this beautiful revolution. And from there, we'll see orbital prizes in the next 5 years.
We should say this was just suborbital today, not orbiting altitude, and certainly not in orbit, but up and down. You think orbiting within 5 years?
I think we'll see the first attempts at orbital shots in about 5 years' time. I think we'll definitely have it within eight. And then beautiful thing is, once you're to orbit, you're two-thirds of the way to anywhere. I would be surprised if within 3 years of being in orbit, we didn't see private companies stockpiling fuel and making a private shot to the moon. I think the genie's out of the bottle, and we're about to see some real amazing things in our lifetime.
We couldn't help doing the back-of-the-envelope calculation here today. 69 miles into space. What, the moon is just 200 and some thousand. I mean, you're a significant fraction of the way there.
240,000 miles to the moon. It's not the distance, it's the energy, it's the velocity that you have to worry about. And
a different project, but this is not endlessly far away.
No, we're starting, and it's, you know, it draw the line between the first Apple or the Mac 128 and a G4 or whatever computer you like using, and American know-how, industry innovation is going to drive it cheaper, higher performance. Just like it has every other field.
A pretty heady day for you, Peter Diamandis. Thanks so much.
I'm excited. It's amazing.
We hear you right there in the Mojave. Thanks for joining us today. Congratulations on giving out the prize.
Thank you.
Peter Diamandis, chairman of the XPRIZE Foundation, which today awarded its $10 million prize. Gregory Clerks, there's a lot more we want to hear from you. Please stand by in London. Listeners, we are talking about today's prize-winning flight into space and the future of personal spaceflight and the privately funded exploration of space. Did you see Spaceship One descending from the heavens today? What do you make of the XPRIZE winner and its implications? Is this just a long joyride or something more? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about today's prize-winning flight into space and the future of personal spaceflight. What do you think? Are you ready to fly into space? How much are you really willing to cough up to do it? And where do you see private industry ultimately fitting into the exploration of space, to the commercial development of space? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined from London by Gregory Clerks, author of Lost in Space. We're joined right now from Los Angeles by Richard Branson, chairman of the Virgin Group, which includes Virgin Atlantic and now Virgin Galactic, a company that plans to take tourists into space by 2007. Good evening. Welcome. Congratulations, Richard Branson.
It's a great day. Nice to talk to you.
This is your craft that won the prize today. Where do you go from here?
We're building five passenger seater spaceships based on today's design, basically, and they will be ready in 3 years' time to take passengers into space. And initially, the price will not be cheap. It'll be about $190,000 a passenger. Mm-hmm. But if we can get the right number of people, we believe that in a few years' time, we can start getting the prices to come down. And, you know, hopefully one day, or definitely in our children's lifetime, they really will be able to aspire to go to space and at a sort of more realistic level. So initially, we're looking for sort of 3,000 pioneers. And based on our initial announcement, we've had something like 5,000 people put their names down. So I think we're going to have a reasonably full spaceships.
Richard Branson, you've been around flights and planes and flying for a long time. You put your money on this particular craft. A lot of people were competing for this prize. How did you pick this one, Paul Allen's and Mr. Rutan's design, their craft, out of all the competitors?
Bert Rutan is the most brilliant aviation designer in the world today, and has had decades of experience behind him. And I think he's the only person that I know that could successfully build a safe private spaceship and take this technology forward. So investing in him was a no-brainer. I mean, we've worked with him on other projects in the past. He just built a beautiful craft for us. Called the Virgin Global Flyer, that's going to attempt to have a go around the world on a solo trip this January without refueling. And he's an absolutely brilliant person. Paul Allen was brave enough to put his hard-earned money that he'd made from Microsoft into getting the ball rolling, and he's basically passed the baton to us to take it on to the next stage. We've accepted his baton with relish.
You are a famous adventurer, whether it's in flying or high-altitude ballooning, and no doubt there are a lot of others who would like to go to space, into space as well, Richard Branson. But how do you ultimately see this? Is this about thrill rides to space? Is that enough to make an industry? Where does it ultimately go?
Well, the Virgin Group is quite a wealthy group of companies, and we make money in lots of different areas, whether it's mobile phones or airlines or whatever. We see this as a standalone business where the pioneers that invest in the initial flights, any money that we make from that, all of it will be plowed back into trying to make it more and more realistically affordable for future generations to be able to fly, to be able to then push the barriers forward from suborbital to orbital flights, maybe put a moon in the sky, maybe put a hotel in the sky, maybe even have a hotel on the moon one day. But basically, it's got to be inspirational. And when you turn on your news these days, all you see is the most awful pictures for our kids, most terrible stories. And you know, today was a day of celebration. And this will involve children around the whole world being able to participate by watching other people going into space and the magnificence of that. And then one day being able to realize that a dream for them when they grow up could be that they'll be able to go into space themselves. And that's worthwhile, you know, pioneering and investing in that possibility and that future.
Well, that's a flagship going to very great heights. And I read that you've said you'll be on that first Virgin Galactic flight, Richard Branson.
I certainly will, and if my father has his wish, he's 87. It's going to take us 3 years to build it. He's very determined to be on it too. I mean, the great thing about these flights is that, and my son actually, he would like to come, so maybe we'll have three generations.
Right, maybe.
You know, you don't have to be incredibly fit to go on them. I mean, you know, you can go up and experience space. You need to be reasonably fit, but I mean, you can go up and experience space and marvel at space.
But I did notice that the flight last week took 20, it rolled 29 times somewhere near the top of its arc into space. This isn't going to be without risk. Presumably, you'll be signing papers getting on this craft that acknowledge that you might not come down.
I would say from talking to Bert that the risks are no more than, say, you know, driving cars or being on motorbikes. I mean, you know, the fact that that spacecraft can roll 27 times and still go up into space shows just how sturdy and how strong it is. I mean, Bert's design is absolutely brilliant in that instead of having to battle your way back through the Earth's atmosphere with enormous heat, with all the risks that Challenger's had in the past, this just turns into a giant shuttlecock, and even if the pilot, you know, had passed out, it would just drift back down to Earth. And so, I mean, it is, I would say, one of the sort of safest, well, certainly the safest form of space travel that's ever been invented. But I suspect it's as safe as, certainly the early airliners. But I suspect, getting as safe as some of the most modern airliners today. I mean, it's got all the latest technology rolled into it.
Well, it's still space, and we want to congratulate you on the aircraft doing what it's done today. The spacecraft, I guess we should say. Richard Branson, congratulations, and thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Cheers. Richard Branson, chairman of the Virgin Group, which includes Virgin Atlantic and now Virgin Galactic, aiming toward space. Gregory Clerks, you're listening on from London. You know well that Richard Branson is an adventurer and a showman, but is he on to something substantive here?
I think what's so interesting about what Richard Branson is doing is that it represents every bit as much as Spaceship One, a real first in this budding new space age. There have been very wealthy people in the past who have funded experimental spacecraft, like Paul Allen has done with Spaceship One. This has happened a number of times. But what you've never had is someone funding the outcome end of the spacecraft. That is saying, I'm not going to pay for developing one. I'm going to pay for replicating one and then starting a business with it. That is a new thing, and I think the timing is right. And Richard Branson is obviously no dummy where business is concerned, so one would expect it to be right. But 10 years ago, this would not have been a smart play. You didn't have a craft that could do what Spaceship One can do. Now it is a smart play. And, of course, the big question is, will the customers come? There are lots of reasons to think that they will, but, of course, that remains to be seen.
At nearly $200,000 a pop, and I'm still trying to get a fix, Gregory Clerks, on where all this goes. Richard Branson took us as far as this suborbital flight, maybe orbiting one day, maybe an orbiting hotel, I think he described there. But is this all about kind of adventure visits, or is there one day industry that goes beyond simply being there?
I think there is a bigger picture involved here, and I think if you would ask most people who have been in this business for a long time, they would say it's the idea of expanding kind of the human space of activity to low Earth orbit. Because we have routine jet travel now, you can really say that people really live and operate on a very regular basis up to about 39,000 feet above the Earth. They work, they play, they socialize, all of those things on a daily basis. There's no reason that can't be expanded to low Earth orbit. And there are some interesting things that could happen up there. There certainly are industrial processes that might be carried out in microgravity that might yield results. They haven't done so to date because the cost of getting things up there to try them out has been prohibitive.
And would this ever be related to Earth travel, that you'd go into space in order to travel more quickly around the Earth, or does that make no sense?
It makes perfect sense, and in fact, that has been a holy grail for a long time. It's also been a holy grail in terms of fast package delivery. Companies like DHL and Federal Express would love to be able to do same-day delivery anywhere on Earth.
Oh, boy, I can see the ads already.
In fact, both of those companies invested in an exhaustive study about 10 years ago that really showed the potential for them. And we're also talking about disaster relief, human transport to and from very hot spots in the world. So there are a lot of things that could be done that would be very relevant to life on Earth.
FedEx from me to you by way of space. What next? Gregory Clerk, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation again from the Mojave Desert in Mojave, California, Jeff Johnson. He's Director of Aviation at Vulcan, Inc., Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen's private asset management company. It funded Spaceship One. It's now partnering with Richard Branson on Virgin Galactic. Jeff Johnson, thanks for being with us tonight, and congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much.
A big day for you all. Have you had a good celebration there?
Well, yeah, we've had a good celebration. It's been a great day. A lot of hard work, and it's finally paying off.
We ran tape earlier in the hour of Paul Allen saying, this is all about making a buck. This is not just, you know, having a good time, as exciting as it may be. What's the business model to make a profit out of this, Jeff?
Well, here, what we've did, we've done at Mojave Aerospace, which is the company that owns the intellectual property that's embodied by Spaceship One,
mm-hmm.
you know, the patent of the feather and the cantilever rocket mount and all the trade secrets that go into making that system work.
No, wait, I have to ask you, the feather, are you talking about the big tail at the back of this craft?
Exactly. We call that when it kind of breaks in half and the tails go upward and it stabilizes itself for reentry, we call that the feather.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it looks sort of like the feather at the back of an arrow here.
That's exactly right, and it acts the same way too. It keeps the feather aligns with the airflow, and it keeps the big flat plate of the wing basically pushing through the air like a frisbee, you know, being pushed through the air the big way, not
mm-hmm.
the thin way.
So you own the intellectual property that this is, I guess.
That is correct.
What do you do with it? How do you make money?
Well, we license it to people. As a matter of fact, we did a deal with Virgin Galactic, and that's how they're being, you know, they've licensed the technology from us, and now they're going to work with whoever they choose, and they're talking with Scaled, I guess, to embody this technology in the second generation of vehicles.
Scale, the company that built the Spaceship
right.
One.
With a Burt's company, Scale Composites.
Right.
And, you know, it's a non-exclusive license. We'll gladly license it to other people if they decide to, you know, go into competition with Virgin or whatever. But as Paul mentioned also in that same press conference, you know, Virgin is basically getting a head start by being an early entrant into the market. And there is some, you know, benefit into going first and kind of capturing the imagination of everyone and getting a head start in developing their craft, because it won't be an overnight mm-hmm. event. It'll mm-hmm. take a few years of work to get the next generation all, you know, worked out, figured out how many seats it's going to have, what the experience is going to be like for those people, and to build that craft, test fly it, and get it ready for service.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Paul Allen, of course, famously rich, a billionaire a number of times over, so he could afford to play with this. But you're saying you've got the intellectual property, you'll license it out. Making money, I guess, would depend on having lots of activity around that intellectual property, lots of people using it. Is space tourism the be-all and end-all, or are there other applications?
Oh, there are definitely other applications. We have had a marked interest in a number of low Earth orbit satellite applications where you could use variations of this technology, and there are a number of military potential military applications through company or areas like DARPA investment companies. You know, DARPA does research contracts.
The government defense program.
That's right, and they do what we call pop up and look down. So it's like quick launch satellite pop up and look down activity. You could imagine a craft. I don't know if we haven't released the pictures yet, but when you look at the videotape from 367,000 feet, you can see, we think you can see the Gulf of Cortez, and we know you can see further north than Lake Tahoe. And from here, which is some 400
it's a big view.
Miles.
It's a big view.
Right, exactly. And if you can imagine being in someplace safe, like Saudi Arabia, and wanting to look over to someplace dangerous, like Iraq, all the time, you could fly these. If you had a number of craft like this, you could pop up and look down, you know, four or five times a day instead of having to fly a satellite over an area that might be hard to fly satellites over.
Well, tourism and military, and we are expanding in this age in particular the spectrum of what we understand about the use here. Jeff Johnson, congratulations again on the flight today, and thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Jeff Johnson, Director of Aviation at Vulcan Incorporated, Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen's private asset management company that funded Spaceship One. We are joined now in Gregory Clark's Hang With Us in London. We're joined in Pasadena, California, by Louis Friedman. He is executive director of the Planetary Society, a space advocacy group. He participated in congressional reviews of space exploration missions. He's author of Star Sailing, Solar Sails, and Interstellar Travel. Louis Friedman, thanks for joining us tonight.
Glad to be here.
We're trying to get some perspective on what's happened today. There's a lot of excitement about the X Prize being won, about these very, very high flights into space, and where this all might go. Are you giddy with excitement about this, or is this just baby steps? How do you see it?
Well, it's certainly a laudable achievement, and the groups that were involved deserve all the credit they can do. They just did a tremendous job. I don't think it presages a great day for commercial space exploration. This is more like barnstorming in the early part of the century for aviation, which really didn't have a big impact on the development of the aviation industry. It took World War I and the Postal Air Services to do that. I think this is a great achievement, but let's remember that a couple of decades ago, Pan Am took bookings for orbital space flights. It's an enormous step to find a way to make money out of these things. And I was very sorry to hear these earlier speakers to speak only of a business plan. In space, things go wrong, and everybody who gets into space needs a failure plan. And these people, just like our people, just like all people, they won't be perfect right to begin with. And so there's going to be hiccups along the way. And I guess I'm advocating a little more realism into the subject than I've heard.
That's great. So when you look at private industry and space, is this a match that works, or does it take the deep pockets of governments that can absorb terrible financial losses, losses of life, and all the rest, as the United States government has and others, and keep going? Is there a real big long-term role for private enterprise in space?
Well, certainly there's a role for private enterprise, and the seeding of technology and creativity like that exhibited today is terrific. Stuff like we're trying to do with our first solar sail mission and the Planetary Society is terrific. But to explore other worlds, to make discoveries about our universe, and to make discoveries about our environment and the environment of the solar system, this is going to take government. These are what the governments do best. These are the great enterprises of space exploration, and I wouldn't want to see these barnstorming ventures become the replacement for the great exploration missions that we all envisage, or the great scientific discoveries that we're making in space.
This is a very private industry-oriented administration we have at the moment. Do you think the Bush administration imagines private industry taking over from NASA in some degree?
Well, I hope not, because and I don't think they do. I think we went that route before. There was a group that wanted to do a private mission to Halley's Comet, and they convinced the government, the United States government, not to do it. And, of course, nobody did it then. There was groups a few years ago who said that if the government would get out of the way, the moon would be developed. Well, the government got out of the way, and we had 20 years of no moon missions. So I think that there's a lot more realism now than there was a couple of decades ago. If the government gets out of the way, these things are not going to get done, and that isn't to say that the private sector shouldn't be encouraged to do the innovative and creative ideas that we all want to work on.
Louis Friedman, hold it there. We'll come back. We want to hear much more. Gregory Clark's in London, Louis Friedman in Pasadena. We're going to take a short break here. We're talking about today's prize-winning flight into space. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about today's prize-winning flight into space and the future of personal space flight, and maybe the privately funded exploration of space. I'm joined tonight from London by Gregory Clark's space writer and author of Lost in Space, and from Pasadena, California, Louis Friedman, executive director of the Planetary Society, a space advocacy group, author of Star Sailing. You can join this conversation as well. Do we have a breakthrough here? Beyond thrill rides, how will industry make money in space? And do you picture orbiting hotels, condos on the moon, vacations on the Sea of Tranquility? Do you welcome or fear the private sector's plunge into space? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Frank is calling from Boston. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Hey, Don. How are you?
Just great. Thanks.
Yeah, well, I was calling. I'm an old friend of Peter Diamandis.
Oh, a big day for him.
we've been working together for a long time on this issue. It's a great day. And I wrote a book some years ago called The Overview Effect. And it's about the experience of being in orbit, looking back and seeing the Earth. And I interviewed 22 people who'd been there. And I think that one of the things to look at is really the philosophical implications of this experience. And I think it's one of the things that's going to really bring people to this new enterprise.
So you're foreseeing humans going up, seeing that big curvature of the Earth and being changed.
Yeah, I mean, my experience in talking to astronauts is that it does change your consciousness. It changes what you identify with, and, you know, the things that we know intellectually about the Earth, which is that we're all part of it, we're all connected to one another, and that the Earth is a really kind of a small oasis in a great universe, is something that the astronauts and the people who've gone experience emotionally.
And something that...
experience it directly.
And something that Peter Diamandis and Richard Branson in particular, I guess, are counting on a lot of human beings wanting to share. Frank, thanks very much for your call. Gregory Clerks in London. Louis Friedman is warning us, be careful here. There's still a huge role for government. There are huge risks here. There are many, many roles that private enterprise is not likely to take on any time soon at all. And yet our caller Frank says, you know, the appeal of just seeing this and experience it is great, and it can be consciousness changing, I guess.
I agree with Dr. Friedman that I don't think that private enterprise is going to be taking on the long haul, big ticket exploration initiatives anytime soon, nor do I think that's a good idea. I think the effect of what might be called a sort of a new space revolution, I'm not certainly the first person who said that, is both practical and it's perceptual. It's practical in the sense that in terms of human space flight, NASA in particular has lost a lot of credibility in recent years. The shuttle has not turned out to be the vehicle that NASA said it would. It's not cheap. It's not frequently, it's not easy to fly. It's had its problems, as we know, from the two tragic losses of vehicles in the past 20 years. There's a space station that's very expensive, that's very behind schedule. A lot of people don't really know what it does. But there's still interest in human spaceflight, and I think a lot of that interest does stem from those very, very early promises in the space age that eventually what happened with Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo would be translated for the regular person, that everybody would get this experience at some level. And so if Spaceship One can translate into that kind of experience, and initially for very wealthy people, but perhaps with time for less wealthy people, that could only help what NASA's trying to do in terms of exploration. It will get people excited about it in a different kind of way. And so I think that's a good thing for everybody involved.
So an auxiliary role to keeping public support up, perhaps, for space travel. Jack is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you, Jack.
I just want to say that Paul Allen and Burt Rutan and everybody involved in this will be probably recorded in history as great Americans. That I'm glad to see that private industry is now taking the lead on space exploration. It seems to me that NASA's kind of held on to it for way too long and been kind of stagnant. And this leads into, I think, now the next thing is for private industry to get more involved with the cancer research and get rid of the Food and Drug Administration, who's basically held back, you know, any great, you know, changes in the advance on the cancer treatment.
So you're in the privatized parade, and you'd like to see it work in space and maybe beyond. But let me ask you, Jack, how far do you think private space exploration can actually go? You know the kind of resources that go into the big projects, the moon, Mars.
This is a very libertarian idea here, small L libertarian.
Yep.
And basically, private enterprise has given us most of what we have. The government is always known as being a force, and the bigger the government, the bigger the force, and the less, you know, creativity and stimulus people have because they're held back with their ideas because of government regulations and bureaucrats.
I hear it. It's an exciting day on the high frontier for libertarians. Jack, thanks very much for your call. Louis Friedman, how do you imagine over time the roles of public and private space travel, exploration, the works will sort out?
Well, you know, I'd like to, maybe I'll get a little assertive,
both
in comment to Peter Diamandis and to your first caller on this thing. I think for almost everybody alive today on Earth, it's going to be easier to be a government-sponsored astronaut than it is for them to become rich enough to be able to afford a ride to space. Peter Diamandis could have flown earlier if he had become an astronaut. He will fly more often if he had become an astronaut than he would as a private citizen. So that's a rather assertive claim on my part, and it's just a prediction that probably I won't live long enough to test. But what I'm thinking is that for a long, long time, the government program is going to be where the action is. It's going to be the advances in human spaceflight that take us beyond Earth orbit to the exciting ideas of new discoveries of our solar system and about our own planet. And the novelty of the private sector doing these things in space will be just that, but they will not be the thing that will really advance space exploration, nor will they be the things that are in the reach of the ordinary citizen.
And what about technological advance? Do you imagine a private enterprise finding new solutions to space travel that might supplement NASA, that might even show the way for NASA, or not even that?
Oh, sure. I think so. I think there's a tremendous role for private-public cooperation and private and stimulating each other. And we, as a public interest group, our own Planetary Society, which is completely privately funded, has come up with ideas like the Mars microphone and taken them to another world where the government wasn't willing to do it. I think there's a tremendous role for the private sector to stimulate new ideas and creative new inventions of what they've done in the computer industry and what they've done in the health industries.
Yeah.
Are tremendous advantages.
So take it on up. And Gregory Clerks, to you, how do you see the private role unfolding here? Lewis Friedman's pretty skeptical. You're writing in your book about the fall of NASA, your words, and the dream of a new space age. It seems that private enterprise would be no small part of that.
Well, when I was talking about fall of NASA, I was really referring primarily to human spaceflight. And, you know, obviously the robotic exploration has been fantastic. You know, we can look at the two rovers on Mars now and Stardust mission and all sorts of other fantastic discovery missions. But I think in terms of human spaceflight, it's hard to argue that NASA has fallen in terms of what it was trying to do, public interest, public esteem. And I do not think it's a given, even with a new plan from President Bush to take humans back to the moon and possibly onto Mars. I don't think it's a given that those things are going to happen. And I don't think it's a given they're going to happen without some sort of other impetus, getting people interested and getting people excited and involved. And I do think that private human space travel can do that. I think, too, the idea of Peter being an astronaut, he looked at the situation at hand and saw that the astronaut corps was chock-a-block with people who were jostling for their place in line, and a lot of people in the astronaut corps don't ever get to fly.
So he's made his own way. It's a private way, and you're looking at that as pretty promising tonight.
I think so. I hope so.
Gregory Clerks, it's been great having you tonight from London. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's been fun.
Gregory Clerks, author of Lost in Space, The Fall of NASA and the Dream of a New Space Age, and Lewis Friedman in Pasadena, California, thanks so much for your perspective tonight.
Thank you.
Lewis Friedman, executive director of the Planetary Society, a space advocacy group. He is author of Star Sailing, Solar Sails, and Interstellar Travel. You can continue this conversation on the private exploration of space at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And now to take a turn, the case to go to war in Iraq hinged, in no small part, on the assertion that Saddam Hussein was working to build a nuclear weapon. Before the war, administration officials pointed to the fact that Iraq was trying to buy high-strength aluminum tubes as evidence of this. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice said at the time that the tubes were, quote, only really suited for nuclear weapons programs. But on Sunday, the New York Times reported that the administration, and specifically the National Security Advisor's staff, had been told a year earlier that Energy Department officials believed that the tubes were for conventional weapons, not nuclear. The detailed Times report raises the issue of whether the administration was a victim of faulty intelligence or whether it deliberately chose to ignore intelligence analysis when making the case for war in Iraq. Joining me now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Jim Walsh, Executive Director of the Managing the Atom Project at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Jim Walsh, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening, Tom.
So you've watched this a long time and may have known a lot of it, but many of us got introduced to a lot of detail yesterday in the three long pages in the New York Times that seemed to suggest that it would have been hard to make the case on the basis of what intelligence officials were telling the White House, that indeed these tubes were headed for a nuclear program. What unfolded here? What happened?
Well, it is a pretty damning article that really, I think, quite specifically lays out the story and how what we had here at its best was really incompetence. That is to say, the only good explanation I think that the administration has is that administration officials weren't informed of the fact that the overwhelming consensus was that these tubes were not intended for a nuclear program. If that's the case, then that shades towards incompetence. But the more likely explanation is a willful ignoring of the evidence that they did have. This wasn't a failure of intelligence. The intelligence was there. It was overwhelming in one direction. Instead, it appears as if policymakers ignored the evidence that they had.
September 2002, Vice President Dick Cheney saying that the United States had, quote, irrefutable evidence about these thousands of tubes of high-strength aluminum and that they were headed for clandestine Iraqi uranium centrifuges, which, of course, would be part of a nuclear weapons development program, or well could be. And you're saying that when Dick Cheney was making statements like that, he knew otherwise?
I think it's likely that that was the case. You know, I remember that Meet the Press interview. I was sitting at home that Sunday watching TV, and when the vice president made these claims that Iraq had, quote, reconstituted its nuclear program, my jaw dropped to the ground. Now, I thought, like a bunch of other folks, that Iraq likely had chemical and maybe a little biological weapons left over from the Iran-Iraq war. But the International Atomic Energy Agency and other analysts who had been studying the Iraqi nuclear program in no way thought that Iraq was close to having a nuclear weapon. So that was a pretty bold statement by the vice president at the time. And now we read in this New York Times reporting that over a year prior to those statements, the Department of Energy put its A-team together, its best analysts on issues relating to centrifuges, and they came up with a host of reasons why they thought these tubes were not intended for centrifuges, but were instead intended to be used as artillery tubes, and that they matched exactly the specifications that Iraq had used in previous artillery tubes. And it wasn't just the Department of Energy. It was also people in the State Department. It was also Britain's intelligence service and the International Atomic Energy Agency who went over the new data. You'll remember in the run-up to the Gulf War, they disputed the claim that these were intended for the nuclear program. So, again, the preponderance of evidence, and it was established well before the run-up to the war, as you say, a year before Vice President Cheney's comments, seemed to suggest that the evidence pointed in the opposite direction.
So, Jim, we've just got a minute here, but on the Sunday morning talk shows yesterday, Condoleezza Rice was essentially saying, well, yes, there was some evidence analysis to the contrary, but it was sort of a toss-up. We had to go with the conservative assessment. You're saying, no, it was the preponderance of interpretation that these were not for a nuclear weapons program.
That's right, Tom. And I think, if anything, these Sunday comments really raise more questions. I mean, if she is still saying this, that really points to the sort of willful disregard hypothesis. She said people are still debating this. And when you say that, that's like saying people, to go to your last segment, are still debating whether we've really walked on the moon or not. Yes, it's true. Some people dispute whether we walked on the moon, but most of us accept that as a given fact. And most people in the community and outside of the community believe that this is a dead issue, that those tubes were not for the nuclear program.
But with a presidential election on the near horizon now, it doesn't look like the White House is going to be acknowledging anything else anytime soon, Jim Walsh.
You're absolutely right.
There we are. Fascinating reporting and important backdrop to very big decisions that we're still living with. Jim Walsh, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Jim Walsh, Executive Director of the Managing the Atom Project at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.